From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Civil wars have torn apart Bosnia, Rwanda, and Somalia. Shelby Foote says civil wars are often the most savage wars. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Foote about the civil war that tore apart the United States. Foote was the principal commentator on the PBS series The Civil War. His new book is about the Gettysburg Campaign. Last week, astronomers watched a comet collide with Jupiter. 350 years ago, Galileo watched Jupiter and started his own collision course with the Catholic Church. We'll talk with James Reston Jr. about his new biography of the great 17th century astronomer. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new historical novel, Henry and Clara, about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and the aftermath. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Defense Secretary William Perry is going to Africa this weekend to look at the U.S. military's efforts to help the Rwandan refugees. Perry says he's made no decision on whether to send American forces into Rwanda itself. Troops are currently coordinating aid deliveries through Uganda and helping at refugee camps in Zaire. The general in charge of the operation has been quoted as saying that as many as 3,000 troops could be sent to Rwanda to set up aid stations for returning refugees. France's prime minister said today that Europe needs to create a permanent force to deal with humanitarian crises worldwide like the Rwandan refugees. The French leader made the comment before leaving on a trip to West Africa. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Prime Minister Edouard Balladur said Europe needs to create a humanitarian force to try to prevent new crises like the one in Rwanda. Balladur said he would work towards this when France takes over the rotating presidency of the European Union in January. Officials said the prime minister will discuss the situation in Rwanda with the leaders of Senegal, the Ivory Coast, and Gabon. Balladur is expected to urge them to take part in the United Nations force that's supposed to take over from French troops in Rwanda in August. Balladur said France will withdraw all of its troops by August 22nd. Military officials said the pullout has already begun, that France is starting to withdraw troops from the security zone it set up in western Rwanda. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Italian news agency ANSA says magistrates investigating tax fraud by big businesses have issued an arrest warrant for Paolo Berlusconi, the brother of media tycoon turned prime minister Silvio Berlusconi. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports.
In an unconfirmed report, ANSA said the warrant was issued as part of a wide probe into millions of dollars of kickbacks paid to tax inspectors by large companies in exchange for favorable audits. Paolo Berlusconi, who heads the family's property businesses, was named as the one who authorized the bribes by the top tax accountant of the Berlusconi Fininvest holding company, who is currently in detention. The move came only a week after the prime minister suffered a humiliating defeat over a decree banning preventive custody for white-collar crime suspects. Yesterday, while not mentioning his brother, Silvio Berlusconi lashed out at Milan magistrates, accusing them of interfering in politics and warning that judicial excesses could have a disastrous effect on the free enterprise system. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
The government says a jump of more than 1% in durable goods orders in June shows the manufacturing sector is doing well. The increase was led by automobile orders. Many analysts had expected to see orders increase only half as much as they did because of rising interest rates. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average near the close was down 17. This is NPR. A defector from North Korea, believed to be the prime minister's son-in-law, says North Korea is using negotiations to stall while it builds nuclear warheads. Kang Myung-do has told reporters in Seoul that North Korea already has 5 warheads and has made great progress on developing a missile system to deliver them. North Korea has denied accusations by U.S. intelligence officials that it is making nuclear weapons, but it has refused to prove its innocence to international inspectors by opening its nuclear facilities. South Korean officials say Kang defected via a third country in May and that he has documents that show he is the prime minister's son-in-law. A prominent media study group says the U.S. is suffering from an identity crisis when it comes to foreign policy. The director of the Times Mirror Center for the People and the Press testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee today. NPR's Caroline Clark Kelly has more.
Andrew Kohut says polling done by his organization indicates that lawmakers and other people the public look to for answers are divided on what U.S. priorities should be. Kohut says the public seems to be most concerned about issues such as trade and drugs and not about world trouble spots.
Our periodic news interest surveys finds very small percentages of the public paying attention to Bosnia and Haiti, let alone to Rwanda and the Ukraine. For example, at no point over the past 2 years have we found more than 20% of Americans able to identify the Serbs as the protagonists of the Bosnian Muslims.
Kohut says the public is comfortable with the U.S. taking the lead in humanitarian missions in Africa, Asia, and the Americas, but is reluctant to see the U.S. take on the role of policeman in those areas. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
A committee of House and Senate members has been working today on the anti-crime bill, trying to resolve differences between their two versions. The final package is expected to include a ban on assault-type firearms. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Shelby Foote says civil wars are often the most savage wars, and you can certainly find evidence for that in Bosnia and Rwanda. Foote is an expert on the American Civil War. He became a familiar presence after serving as the principal commentator on the PBS Civil War series. He's the author of a 3-volume history of the war. His writing on the Gettysburg Campaign has just been republished by the Modern Library under the title Stars in Their Courses. In addition to his historical works, Foote has written 6 novels, including Love in a Dry Season and Shiloh. He grew up in Greenville, Mississippi, and now lives in Memphis. Foote says our Civil War was unlike the civil wars of today.
Our Civil War, it seems to me, is exceptional in many ways. For one thing, it's commonly said that wars don't settle anything. That war settled a great many things. And the others that I have followed don't seem to me ever to settle much. Revolutions do, but civil wars don't. That's why Southerners wanted to call it a revolution.
You've described the Civil War as the central event in our history.
Yeah, so what I meant by that was it defined our character. The revolution set us free, gave us the Constitution, gave statements as to what this country was all about with regard to civil liberties and other things. But it was the Civil War that determined which way we were going. One part of the nation was determined not to go the way it seemed to be going by 1860, and the other side wanted to go even further in the direction that the other side did not want it to go. And I seriously doubt that despite our reputation for being able to compromise things, there was really no way to settle this thing except by fighting. The fact that it went on for 4 years and cost over 1 million casualties was certainly not intended at any point. It just happened so. It was, however, as Robert Toombs said, a war between one form of society and another form of society.
What personal meaning has the Civil War had for you? And I assume it has to have some because you spent about 20 years of your life writing your series of books about the Civil War.
Well, I'm from Mississippi, and Southerners tend to be more interested in that war than the rest of the nation. Part of that psychological, too, if you look back on your youth, if you're a man anyhow, the fights you remember that you got in were the ones you lost. You remember those best, and of course the South got about as thoroughly defeated as any nation, if it could call itself that, has ever been defeated. And we're not apt to forget that, nor are we apt to forget what followed it. Reconstruction was about as far opposite from something like the Marshall Plan as you can get.
You use the word we. Do you think of yourself as personally having lost the war? Do you feel a personal part of that?
Yes, I do. And I think that's inescapable, too. You are where you came from. If I'd been a young man in 1861 and the war had started, no matter how much I was opposed to slavery, how much I saw the right on the other side and the wrong on my side, I still would have gone with my people.
Why?
It's you are that people, and you can fulminate against it and everything else, but when it comes down to choosing sides, you go with your people. There are people who didn't, and I respect their choice, but for the most part, you do that. It's a form of patriotism, narrowed down.
Do you have relatives who fought in the Civil War and whose stories were handed down as you were growing up?
Yes, my grandfather commanded the Knoxville Cavalry at Shiloh, for instance, and served through the war. It's a very close relationship. Other members of my family were in it, in Barksdale's Brigade at Gettysburg, for instance, so that I take a particular interest in those things when I touch them. I've been on battlefields with various people, and the invariable thing you get, whether they're Northerners or Southerners, they want to say, where were the Georgia troops, or where were the Iowa troops? They feel that strong connection.
Well, let's get to the Battle of Gettysburg, which is the subject of your new book, Stars and Their Courses. And this was the bloodiest battle ever fought on American soil. Would you give us a sense of the losses?
Well, there was a total of about over 150,000 men on that field, well over 150,000, in fact, about 165,000. But the casualties were just about exactly 50,000. Slightly more Confederates than Northerners. The Confederates lost about 28,000, and the North lost about 23,000, somewhere in there.
Why were the losses so great?
The losses were so great because they fought by old-style tactics with very modern weapons. The rifle that was used in that war was as accurate, as hard-hitting, and in some way even more deadly than our modern Garand or Springfield. It was accurate at a range of 200 to 300 yards, whereas the tactics had been designed for a smoothbore musket whose accuracy was maybe 30 yards at the most. And they believed that to mash your fire, you had to mash your men in attacking. So they lined up shoulder to shoulder, marched against the position, and of course got blown away. Time after time after time, Pickett's charge is just the biggest example of it. There were plenty of others.
So, really, if you were a soldier in that battle, you knew if you were toward the front, you were going to die, period, right?
There was a very good chance that you would die. Casualties ran very high in Pickett's division. Perhaps it was at least 60% of those men were casualties or were captured.
Have you often tried to put yourself in that position of a soldier who was in the front lines?
I not only have tried, I have. Made that advance across that field, had the emotions I hope that those men had, and I'm still marveling at how men could do that. The simplicity of those men, in the best sense, was what enabled to do it. That and unit pride. In the Civil War, both on the northern side and the southern side, groups, whole regiments, came from definite regions of a state, and company would be from a particular town. So you had a loyalty to each other, which meant that if you refused to go, you were letting down these people that you'd fought the war with up till then, and you'd be going home, those of you who survived, and everybody in that little town would know what you had done when you refused to go. It would have taken more nerve not to go than it would to go.
Have you also wondered what it must have felt like to be a general responsible for such awesome losses?
To me, it's almost impossible to do that. I don't know how those men managed it. One clue to tell you that they didn't manage it is no victory in that war, except for Vicksburg, where there was a siege and Appomattox, which wound it up. These huge battles, the victor was not able to follow up his victory. He was as badly hurt as the defeated side. So that in battle after battle, he would win these great victories like Chancellorsville or Fredericksburg and not be able to pursue the enemy. There was constant criticism for not going into Washington after First Manassas, say. They were in no condition to go into Washington any more than the enemy army was able to keep them from going into Washington.
So you kind of find the general's position unfathomable.
Yes, I don't understand how they stood the strain, and in some ways they didn't stand the strain. It must have been horrendous for them. But not only the generals right on down the line, but the command decision to commit men to the kind of slaughter you know was fixing to happen requires a. I don't know what you call it, but it requires something I don't believe I could do.
Toward the end of your book about Gettysburg, you describe how General Lee took the blame for the defeat at Gettysburg. Is that a surprising thing?
It's not only surprising, it's absolutely unheard of. Every other general I ever heard, especially after a defeat, had all kind of blame to hand around. This person didn't do what he's supposed to, and therefore that happened, so on. Lee walked out on that field, met those men coming back, many of them badly wounded, and said, "It is all my fault. I may have asked of you more than men could give. This is my fault. Rally now and help me. Help me. It is all my fault." He said it on the field. He said it the next day to Longstreet in a sort of apology for not having taken his advice. He said it in his report to the president, and the rest of his life, after you would expect all his defensive feelings to come to the front, he still said, "It is all my fault."
Do you agree with him that it was his fault?
I do. A lot of people don't. They try to put the blame on Longstreet. They do various things because they don't like to speak ill, as they say, of General Lee. It is not speaking ill of General Lee. When you understand, this book is called Stars and Its Courses, and that title is the clue to what the book really is about. It's how fate pulled Lee closer and closer and closer to disaster. It was a 3-day battle. On the first day, he won a victory that wasn't exploited. On the second day, he almost broke that line. He got up on the ridge and had to pull back. Then on the third day, he said, "This is what will do it." And the disaster of Pickett's Charge occurred. So that he was like Sisera in the Bible. The stars and their courses fought against him.
Are you surprised that after a war like the Civil War, the whole nation wouldn't turn into pacifists?
The nation did turn into something resembling pacifists. The longest period in our history without a war, I believe, was from about 1865 to 1898 with the Spanish-American War.
And you think that's no coincidence?
Not exactly. I think those men had had enough of war and the horror of it.
My guest is historian Shelby Foote, and I'm sure you know him from the Civil War series that was on PBS. There's an excerpt of his 3-volume history of the Civil War that's just been republished. It's called Stars and Their Courses, and it's about the Gettysburg campaign. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist and historian Shelby Foote. His latest book is about the Gettysburg campaign. It's called Stars in Their Courses. How much did you grow up with the Civil War? I'm wondering even if like you think your view of say Lincoln was different than people in the North growing up, learning their history.
Yes, that was in a different time. I'm 77 years old, so we're talking about the 1930s. As a schoolboy, I learned obscene doggerel about Abraham Lincoln. There was a vilification of Yankees in general. There was a very different attitude, and I'm glad my son now, who's 32, he doesn't believe any such thing ever happened, that there was that kind of feeling. And I'm glad.
Were there things you learned that you later had to unlearn?
Many things I had to unlearn. Many, many things I had to unlearn. I had to unlearn the belief that the southern planter made and ruled the earth for the earth's own good. It's not true. They were exploitive, bad crunch of people, almost as bad as the robber barons up the country.
I'm curious about your own experience with war, since you've written so much about war. I know you served in Europe during World War II as a field artillery captain. Were you ever romantic about war?
Yes, I think we were all somewhat romantic about war until we were exposed to the horror of it. I think it's necessary to be somewhat romantic about war if you're going to engage in it, or you'd run the other way as hard as possible.
So what were some of the early sobering experiences you had on the battlefield?
I was never under fire on the battlefield. I was a captain of artillery and got in a terrible argument with a colonel in the artillery thing and got sent home and joined the Marine Corps and served for a year and didn't get in combat there because they dropped the bomb just as I was about to cross the Pacific. But I got to know the Army, and believe me, it's a very valuable experience when you have to deal with the politics of the military and have to understand the command structure. Even as simple a thing as knowing close order drill and the manual of arms are a big help to you when you start writing about war.
You mentioned you were sent home. You were actually court-martialed, I believe, for visiting your girlfriend in Belfast.
That's right.
Why did you do it? I mean, I can only assume you knew you weren't supposed to be doing that.
Well, I did. Many people around me did. It was this colonel who was out to get me, and that's Army politics. I belonged to a battalion that was 54 miles from Belfast, and there was a division order that vehicles were not to be used for recreation beyond a distance of 50 miles. And we commonly made our trip tickets out as 49 miles. I made mine out as 49 miles and was charged with falsifying a government document.
So everybody was doing this?
Right.
Were you upset to be court-martialed, and did you think that this was going to be a permanent block on your record that would ruin your life?
Yes, I had some of that feeling. I was in despair. I felt very guilty about not having measured up to what was required of me, including getting along with an unreasonable man, and that was a bad scene. However, I came on home, worked for about 4 to 6 months for Associated Press in New York there on the city desk, and couldn't take it any longer and went down and joined the Marine Corps. That was in January of 45, and went through Paris Island boot camp. My fellow recruits used to have a lot of fun with me, saying, I understand you used to be a captain in the Army. You might make a pretty good Marine private. they had a lot of fun with me. But I liked the Marine Corps. I liked a lot of things about it.
Why did you go back for more?
It has to do with the same thing I joined in the first place. I didn't want something that big going on in the world without being part of it. I also had this regional thing about when something like that comes along, you engage.
Now, what led you toward writing a Civil War history? I know an editor suggested that you do it, but editors suggest lots of things that people don't follow through on. There had to be more than that.
I was born and raised in Greenville, Mississippi, and lived there while writing the first 5 novels. Then I'd reached a point where I wanted to pause and then write another series of 5 novels. And about that time, Bennett Cerf, then the head of Random House, asked if I would be willing to write a short history of the Civil War. And it seemed like a good thing to do during this period of gestation for be a good occupation. And after all, I had to do something to make a living. So I said I would. And I sat down to outline it, and did outline it pretty thoroughly, and saw as soon as I got halfway through the outline that I was not interested in the little resume of the war. So I wrote to Bennett and told him I'd be glad to do it, but I'd have to go spread eagle whole hog on the thing, and it would run 3 volumes. And they had some kind of meeting up the country and said, okay, go ahead. So I did for the next 20 years.
One of the controversies now about American history has to do with a Disney history theme park that's in the works for Virginia. And you're one of the historians who's spoken out against this theme park. What are your problems with it?
I have the problems that are most strongly emphasized, that I don't think that area ought to be desecrated in that particular way.
That area of Virginia?
That area of Virginia. It's called Piedmont. It's a beautiful region, and many, many important historical things happened there, not only the Civil War, but all the way back, but most especially the Civil War. Haymarket is less than 5 miles from Manassas, where 2 great battles were fought. And the overflow from the Disney Park will have a profound effect on that region around Prince William County. Incidentally, some of my people came from there. There was a house named Waverly right near Haymarket. It's not there anymore, but my people live there. So that I don't like being called an outsider. Incidentally, they didn't call my forebears outsiders when they went up and fought in the Army in Northern Virginia. But my main objection to it, in addition to that, and with me more sharp, is Disney tends to sentimentalize anything he touches. The chipmunks are bright little creatures instead of little things that'll bite your fingers. Mice scurry around. All that. And as long as it's fantasy, I have no objection. I grew up with Mickey Mouse and enjoyed all of them. But I want him to let history alone. I don't want him to do what was done to Davy Crockett. I don't want false history, sentimentalized history, to be presented to our children as the way of getting them engaged in history. I don't believe in a false thing being a good way to get people attracted toward a good thing.
You know, syndicated columnist William Safire said that it's intellectually arrogant to block the construction on the grounds that it might misinterpret the past. He says if historians disagree, they're obliged to denounce fuzzy interpretations and rebut the rewriting of history, but they shouldn't try to stop the theme park.
I'm aware that arrogance comes pretty close to being a mortal sin, but I don't at all mind being intellectually arrogant against something that I'm opposed to in an intellectual way, such as Disney establishing a park that's going to tell our young people what American history was.
You know, you could easily make the argument that so few young people are learning anything about history or interested at all in history that it would be a good thing to have an entertaining theme park approach to learning something about history.
It would depend on what that park was, and I really am opposed to sentimentalizing history. Sentimentalizing a thing is the greatest sin you can make where art is concerned, and I would be opposed to it on that ground as in any case. I would almost rather think I knew absolutely nothing about history than to have what I consider a false sense of history. I'm leaning too heavily on that, but it happens to be I'm hipped on the subject. I don't even mind being arrogant about it, as we say.
Why do you consider sentimentality to be such a great sin?
It's a falsification. Sentimentalists, when they weep, their tears aren't even salty. They don't suffer. They don't see pain because they know that pain's going to be alleviated. In Disney productions, the good are going to come out absolutely triumphant and happy. The evil are going to get what's coming to them. Life is not like that, and I don't think people should be taught that life is like that. Incidentally, the old fairy tales, Grimm and Andersen, they're not like that.
Were you excited by history when you were young?
Not in school. History was very badly taught. I think one of the reasons is teachers want to teach in a way that they can grade. So you have to memorize the 13 steps of the Treaty of Utrecht, and they can give you a grade on that. You either got 71% or 82%. And if they ask you a discussion question, they don't know how to grade it. They've got the great burden of having to read it. And I think that's one of the reasons for it, including lack of skill in teaching. It's not easy to teach history. It takes somebody who understands it.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Americans who are Civil War buffs, whose hobby is collecting Civil War memorabilia and other things along those lines. And I wonder what you make of that.
I've never been interested much in memorabilia, many balls and gold buttons and things like that. But they get a great kick out of it, and the reenactors learn a lot of history. There's a great deal of insistence on authenticity among reenactors, and I like that. I've only been to one full-scale reenactment. That was Shiloh on the 125th anniversary, and I really enjoyed it. It was great to see.
Shelby Foote. His writing about the Gettysburg campaign is published in a new modern library edition called The Stars in Their Courses. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, we stared at the heavens as a comet crashed into Jupiter. The 17th century astronomer Galileo discovered the moons that orbit around Jupiter, which helped him demonstrate the Earth was not the center of the universe. The Roman Catholic Church condemned him for contradicting its teachings about the heavens. It was only in 1992 that the church admitted it was wrong. Coming up, we talk with James Reston Jr. about his new biography of Galileo, which he says is the story of how the church and science split apart. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Henry and Clara, a new historical novel about the couple who was sitting with Abraham Lincoln and his wife the night Lincoln was assassinated. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The United Nations says one of its supply convoys was attacked outside Sarajevo today on a road just closed by the Bosnian Serbs. Two British peacekeepers were hit by small arms fire, and the Reuters News Service says one of them has died. The Serbs have acknowledged that their troops were responsible for the attack and have apologized to the UN commander. The Serbs say they had closed the road because the Muslims were taking weapons into Sarajevo, and the troops thought the convoy was made up of Bosnian government vehicles. Defense Secretary William Perry will travel to Zaire and Uganda this weekend to help coordinate relief efforts for Rwandan refugees. Perry says at this point he does not plan to stop in the Rwandan capital of Kigali, but he says the U.S. is considering the option of eventually basing some relief efforts there.
If the engineering and logistical assessments turn out to be promising, and if the government continues their cooperation, then it's entirely possible that we will want to establish Kigali as a hub, being closer to the areas that are affected, and it would just make practical logistic sense.
Perry says no decisions have been made about sending U.S. troops into Rwanda. So far, there are about 750 American troops on the ground in Zaire and Uganda, and Perry says that number could reach 4,000 within a week. The government's reporting a sharp increase in orders to U.S. factories for big-ticket items in June. The Commerce Department says orders for durable goods shot up by 1.3% for the biggest increase in 5 months. Economist Cynthia Latta says the car category led the way.
Automobile orders were certainly very strong again. Transportation orders were up 2.3%, and we know that it wasn't aircraft. We don't know how much was cars and how much was trucks, but consumers are buying both in great numbers these days. And orders for machinery were very strong, so that says that businesses are still optimistic and encouraged to invest in new and improved capacity.
Durable goods are those items such as automobiles and appliances, which are built to last at least 3 years. Congressional Republicans warned the Democrats today not to try to rush through health care reform legislation. But House Republican Leader Robert Michael and some of his colleagues denied that they plan to intentionally kill the bill by delaying it. The Democratic leadership is putting together a health care reform package to offer for debate as early as next week. Some Republicans have accused the Democrats of keeping the proposals secret and then forcing them to hurry through consideration of the plan. Oregon Republican Bob Packwood has called for a full week of Senate debate on the package. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 3 points today to close at 3720.47. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News. Wildfires continue to burn range and forest land in the Northwest, including fires on the Warm Springs Indian Reservation in Oregon, the Yakima Indian Nation in Washington, and the Flathead Indian Reservation in Montana. Washington State's governor has declared a state of emergency in one county where a wildfire has forced hundreds of people from their homes. Bill Radke of member station KUOW reports.
More than 600 firefighters today hope to keep a 15,000-acre blaze from burning any more homes in north-central Washington state. The fire is in a steep, rocky part of the Wenatchee National Forest. Yesterday, the fire created its own wind gusts of up to 40 miles per hour, and that forced firefighters to watch from a distance as six homes burned. Forest officials say as temperatures rise today, the fire could again start creating its own wind, leaving fire crews with few options. Some 400 residents have been voluntarily evacuated, and an undetermined number were evacuated last night after the blaze burned over a ridge and headed toward homes. There are dozens of fires burning in eastern Washington. The Yakima Indian Nation has also declared a state of emergency on its reservation. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke in Seattle.
The Islamic militant group Hamas has denied it detonated two bombs within 12 hours in London early today and yesterday. The bombs damaged the Israeli embassy and a building housing Jewish groups. The British Foreign Office says it heard from one of its diplomats in Cairo that Hamas had claimed responsibility, but a Hamas spokesman in the Gaza Strip denies it. Hamas and other Muslim extremist groups have opposed the PLO-Israeli agreement for autonomy for Palestinians in Gaza and Jericho. Analysts have seen the London bombings as protests against the Mideast peace process. London police have promised round-the-clock protection for more than 100 Jewish and Israeli sites. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, with the help of the Hubble Space Telescope, we got a glimpse of what happens when a comet collides with a planet. This seems like a good time to talk about Galileo, the 17th century astronomer who was the first to point a telescope at the heavens. His observations changed the course of science. Galileo is the subject of a new biography by James Reston Jr. He also wrote the Time magazine cover story in May about the comet Shoemaker-Levy. He told me his biography of Galileo got him excited about the comet crash on Jupiter. Galileo discovered the moons of Jupiter, and they are named after him, the Galilean satellites.
The moment that Galileo first sees the moons of Jupiter is one of the great moments in the life of Galileo and in the life of science. And so when I finished that historical work, I was very eager to sort of scratch and crawl my way back into the modern world. And here was this event I knew that was going to happen at Jupiter. But it was rather buried in the scientific press. There were little notices here and there. But on the face of it, it was such a knock-your-socks-off kind of a thing that we would actually get to see this collision. So I really wanted to throw myself into it, and luckily Time was very eager to do something special. In point of fact, they took an enormous risk to make it into a major cover story, committing themselves well before they knew whether this thing was really going to be visible.
In your biography of Galileo, you said that what you're looking for is the precise moment when modern history was born. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a very clean thing about the discovery of the telescope. The world view of the entire globe in the 15th and 16th and into the 17th century really revolved around the notion that the Earth was at the center of the universe and man was at the center of God's construction of things, and that the heavens were put up in the sky rather like jewels or diamonds that were there fixed and perfect and uncorrupted, and that these were there really for the pleasure of man put there by God. So that when Galileo comes along and he doesn't actually discover the telescope, but he perfects a spyglass and then brilliantly turns it to the heavens for the first time, he can give you, in this case, scientific evidence that, in fact, the heavens do move. And here again, this brings us back up into the modern age, and last week with Shoemaker-Levy, it is the movement of the moons around the planet of Jupiter that really undercut the Middle Ages view of the world as being in the center of the universe. Here were moons that were actually in motion around another heavenly body, not fixed.
Now, he also observed with his telescope that there were sunspots, and that was considered blasphemous, too. Why?
Well, I love thinking about that last week in connection with Shoemaker-Levy, because the sunspots that Galileo sees on the sun are not that dissimilar from the black splotches that suddenly appeared on Jupiter last week. And again, this stitches back not only to the worldview, but the worldview as it was codified by the Roman Catholic Church, that the heavens were to be perfect; they could not be they could not be corrupted or corruptible. And for a body, the source of our light and heat, to have blemishes on it would mean that it was corrupted in some way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Reston Jr., and his new book is a biography of Galileo. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Reston Jr., we're talking about his new biography of Galileo. Let's talk a little bit about the connection of the church and science at the time. They were the same thing. I mean, there wasn't scientists over here and the church over there.
Well, Terry, you have to understand, I really come out of a kind of novelist sensibility, and the wonder of the Galileo story was that you had this almost perfect a rising action in this one life that comes to the climax in the attack of the Roman Catholic Church on Galileo. But what makes him so much more interesting as an individual is the fact that he was so devout himself. Mm-hmm. If he had been contemptuous of the church and contemptuous of their attack on his science, it would have been a much, much less important case.
When Galileo is making these empirical observations with his telescope that contradict the church's teachings, it backs up what Copernicus had said. Now, what was the church's view of Copernicus, and how far had Copernicus gotten?
Well, Copernicus was actually a canon of the church. He was and had been an advisor to popes, and so that, too, is, I think, a little understood fact. But what Copernicus does is to in effect, spin a new theory about the Earth revolving around the sun and the planets revolving around the sun. But he puts this out as theory only, and the theory and the book which contains it is published at the very end of Copernicus's life. It clearly raises eyebrows at the Vatican. Its implications are clearly difficult and awkward for the Vatican. But the fact that Copernicus is really on his deathbed as this work is published, it means that it just kind of languishes there in the scientific press. But what's different about Galileo from Copernicus is that he brings the evidence of his eyes that comes through the telescope, and he can put the telescope before powerful churchmen, and they can see with their own eyes also these moving moons of Jupiter, for example. And then it becomes for the church to grapple with the new science. How would the church do that?
And the church is trying to figure out how it deals with empirical information that contradicts some very fundamental church teachings of the time.
Precisely. And in Copernicus's case, they could just say, well, you're wrong, and we'll just let your book languish, and that would be that.
How was Galileo punished for his theory?
What happens to Galileo is that he is humiliated in an excruciating moment in human history, where he is forced to recant his beliefs in the Copernican system, And after this this horrible humiliation, he is then sent into exile above Florence. Not many of us would think of that as a terrible fate, I suppose, but he is really under house arrest for the last 8 years of his life in Arcetri, which is right above Florence.
So Galileo dies under virtual house arrest. He dies while he's banned from teaching or even believing his point of view. He's supposed to not believe it anymore. But the church doesn't admit its error until 1992. What reopened the case for the Roman Catholic Church? What reopened the Galileo case?
Well, that is what I had hoped would make this book a, you know, have an aura of being fresh and needed now. The fact that in 1979, this pope decided to reopen the Galileo case, to, as he said, earnestly study it. And then, mysteriously, it took them 13 years to come to a conclusion on it. And my guess is that once they opened up the question, they saw that there was really no way for the church to come out very well in all of this. And I think as important as that is that they were concerned that if they announced a kind of error of judgment in Galileo's case, that it would undermine the authority of the church today in modern times on such questions as abortion and biotechnology and other scientific issues that intersect with morals and with theology. And I think that's why it took them so long. But finally, they do make an announcement. What I'm told about that October 1992 mea culpa of the popes is that he simply said, "We opened it up and we have to come to a conclusion. And if your facts are in order, you're saying this to a cardinal, then we have to come forward." So I think we have to give this pope some real credit.
What explanations does the church give now for condemning Galileo and for taking this long to...
Well, that gets into the more subtle side of it, about what their argument is, whether this is really a sincere and total expression of apology. When you talk to churchmen about the Galileo case, what they're inclined to do is to talk a lot about the disobedience of Galileo. And in order to understand that argument, you have to know the facts a bit. There were really two proceedings against Galileo that were 16 years apart. And in some ways, the more important one was not the one at the end where he's humiliated in front of the cardinals, but the one in 1616 where he is called in by the chief intellectual of the church and told that he is not to teach or hold the Copernican theory. And what Galileo does after that warning by the church is that he goes out and writes this great dialogue called the Dialogue of Concerning the Chief World Systems. And this is interpreted as indeed being an argument for the Copernican theory. And so what churchmen today will say is that the second trial of Galileo had nothing at all to do with the Copernican theory. It had everything to do with whether or not Galileo had been disobedient to the command of the church.
If the Galileo story begins the real split between the church and science, what do you think the legacy of that split has been for both science and the church?
Well, what the Galileo case did to the Roman Catholic Church was to put the label on it as being anti-science and anti-intellectual. And this has been a bone in the throat of the church for 350 years. And they have gone to extraordinary lengths, decade in and decade out, and century in and century out, to prove that they were not like the churchmen who sent Galileo away, but that they were very open to science and that they were promoters of science and knowledge. One of the very interesting things to me is that the Catholic Church brought into existence a set of observatories, and they trained Jesuits to be very fine astronomers. And this began in the late 19th century. There is now a Vatican observatory out on the mountaintop in Arizona, for example, where they do very, very good science. Well, there's no doubt in my mind that all of this emphasis of the Roman Catholic Church in the last 150 years to show that they were welcoming of science and scientific knowledge is really built upon guilt over the Galileo case.
What about the legacy for science?
Well, the legacy for science we saw somewhat last week with Shoemaker-Levy, and I think this is the other side of it, and the regrettable side, that scientists stay as far away from spirituality and from poetry as they possibly can. They feel that science is at least last week it certainly was clear to me that science was about measurement. How big were these comets going into Jupiter, and how big was the energy, and how many megatons, and so on. That science is about measurement. But when something so unique, it was said to be an event that comes once every 1,000 years, and it stitches back to the possibility that the Earth was also hit by comets, and that's how we got our oceans, and that's how we got the constituents of life on Earth. So to actually witness something that may also have happened here and made it possible for living organisms to come into being, that's really a moment for great reflection. And it's not only about the brain, but it's about the soul and the spirit. And scientists are uncomfortable on that turf.
James Reston, Jr., he's the author of a new biography of Galileo. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what will you have about the refugees in Goma?
Hi, Terry. Ann Cooper reports from Zaire on the burial problem there. The United Nations is asking for bulldozers to dig new graves. 2,000 refugees are dying every day. I'll talk with a reporter who's just back from Burundi, which, like Rwanda, also has a Hutu majority and a Tutsi minority. There's fear in Burundi that ethnic warfare could break out there. Jim Zaroli reports from New York on conversations with Jewish organizations about the recent terrorist attacks. And I'll talk with a friend of Helen Cordero, a Pueblo Indian potter in New Mexico who's passed away. She originated the now quite well-known storyteller pottery concept.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer Thomas Mallon has devoted much of his career to exploring the netherworld between history and fiction, truth and lies. His nonfiction book, Stolen Words, chronicles infamous cases of literary plagiarism, and an earlier novel, Aurora 7, is set against the backdrop of astronaut Scott Carpenter's nearly disastrous space flight in 1962. In Mallon's new novel, Henry and Clara, he relies on diary entries, letters, government documents, and his own imaginings to reconstruct the story of a 19th-century couple whose brief brush with history destroyed their lives. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Abraham Lincoln was not alone in the state box at Ford's Theater on that fateful evening of April 14th, 1865. With him were his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, and an engaged couple, Major Henry Rathbone and Clara Harris, who had been invited at the last minute. In the awful, frantic seconds following the assassination, Major Rathbone tried to capture John Wilkes Booth, who slashed Rathbone's left arm, severing an artery. Rathbone eventually recovered and married Clara, although perhaps not without some second thoughts. Clara had spent the hours after the shooting consoling Mrs. Lincoln, even as her fiancé lay nearby in a blood-soaked bed fighting for his life. We know that curious detail because the real Clara Harris divulged it in a letter to a friend. But much else about Thomas Mallon's novel is downright fantasy. In an interview Mallon gave a couple of years ago, he compared his historical novel, then under construction, to Ford's theater itself. The theater collapsed in 1893 and was restored during the 1960s to its exact condition on the night Lincoln died. Some furnishings, like Lincoln's rocker, are replicas, but others are original. Since most visitors to Ford's theater can't distinguish the genuine articles from the fake, the important thing, according to Mallon, is that the details look right to create an evocative atmosphere. Well, I'm no Shelby Foote, but the Civil War era details in Mallon's novel look right to me. We get quick, precise images here of Southern sympathizers in Washington closing their window shutters during Lincoln's inauguration, and of Union soldiers from New York wearing uniforms from Brooks Brothers. In fact, this novel is so convincing, it has the weird, anti-historical effect of dimming your interest in the actual Henry and Clara. Whatever their real story was, it almost certainly can't compare to the macabre tale of twisted passions Mallon cooks up. Henry and Clara's lives seem star-crossed long before that dreadful night at the theater. They were both born into prominent New York political families. But when Henry was 11 and Clara 13, his widowed mother married her widowed father, making the children stepbrother and sister. Mallon vividly portrays the young Henry as one of those sexually dangerous Byronic types, and so, inevitably, Clara falls in quasi-incestuous love with him. Their wedding was endlessly delayed by family objections and by the Civil War. In Mallon's account, when Henry and Clara do finally marry, their happiness is poisoned by memories of the assassination. Henry feels ashamed for not saving the president, and Clara feels guilty for staying with Mrs. Lincoln. For years, Clara mulls over her odd behavior, finally confessing to herself that she had the sense there was an unwelcome secret sewn into the violence of that night that Henry might have disclosed to her while he thought he was on his deathbed. There really is a secret. That's only one of the many literary tricks Mallon uses to recharge the story of the assassination and its aftermath with suspense. Even more dazzling is the climax of this novel, where Henry, whose mind is dislocated by madness, recreates the events of the assassination and thus releases himself and Clara from history's crushing undertow. And for what it's worth, Mallon swears the ending here is true.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Henry and Clara by Thomas Mallon. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Morgia Voblaitis. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.